Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Project Zion podcast. Today is an episode of Cup of Joe, where we discuss aspects and events in church history and the broader restoration history. Our guest today is Locke Mackay. Now, you may know Locke and know that he's a member of the Council of 12, and also that he serves as the Director of Historic Sites for Community of Christ. So, hi, Locke.
Hello, Karen.
So, we've had lots of discussions about church history on the podcast, and you are always a wealth of information, but our topic today is both interesting and uncomfortable, depending on your viewpoint. And it's the topic of polygamy, and more specifically, polygamy in Nauvoo. So because that's an uncomfortable topic, and I'll be honest, it is a little bit of an uncomfortable topic for me, let's review some church history principles that might be helpful to keep in mind. So what are some things that we need to keep in mind as we begin this conversation?
So I'm thrilled that you shared that it's uncomfortable, because I have found that simply saying that out loud makes it less uncomfortable. Some of our church history principles that I think we need to keep in mind as we have this discussion is that history informs but does not dictate our faith. I think it's helpful to be reminded that we support and encourage honest and responsible historical scholarship. And with discussions like these, it is really important to try and guard against presentism. We have a tendency to judge people and events in the past through the lens of the present. That's not fair, although it's going to happen to us in the future as well.
if anybody has some consolation in that, yeah.
Yeah, so please, always in the back of your mind, it's helpful to be thoughtful about presentism. Remember that seeing both the faithfulness and mistakes in our history make it more believable, not less. And finally, we do not legislate or mandate positions on matters of church history. So you're going to hear a little bit about what I think today, but there are plenty of other people who do not share my opinions, and that is fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're not establishing doctrine here. We are simply having discussion about research and scholarship. So very different. Okay. So as we kind of launch into this, what would you say to the Community of Christ folks who might ask, why are we having this discussion? Why are we even talking about this? Not our issue. What would you say to them?
So I would say, like it or not, it's our issue. It is still with us today. It is behind the scenes most often. But for example, as we talk about issues in the church today, like cohabitation, or about baptism and those in polyamorous relationships, it is with us today. And I think it's also really important to talk about, because it has been so uncomfortable to think about this part of our history that we just kind of put our history on the shelf. And by doing that, we have lost connection with not just this painful part of our story, but wonderful and powerful and compelling parts of the story as well. So I have found repeatedly that it is always just under the surface whenever we talk about church history. And if I just throw it out there and let it rise to the surface and address it, and it is so much more comfortable than as we move forward to talk about history.
So you used a term that some people might not be familiar with. So let's clarify some terms. You used polyamorous, and that was not on my list of terms that we might talk about. So let's start with that. Can you give us a very brief definition of polyamorous?
So I think it is multiple loves, poly and amor. So those who have multiple loves in their life. Which is something that is we're seeing quite a bit of in the world today.
Okay, so let's define some other terms as we go on. Polygamy.
polygamy, the practice or custom of having more than one wife or husband at the same time. So it could be multiple wives or multiple husbands.
So what about polygyny? Is that how it's pronounced?
I think it's polygyny, but I...
Polygyny, even better.
Well, these are not terms I use on a regular basis, but polygyny, I think, having more than one wife at a time, and then polyandry, having more than one husband at a time.
So polygamy covers a broader spectrum. Polygyny, I had to think about again how you pronounce that. Polygyny, more than one wife, that's not a term that we hear when we have this discussion. So that's a new term, and polyandry, more than one husband. So how is that different than plural marriage?
So I think that polygamy and plural marriage can be the same thing. But I think that for whatever reason, my sense is among members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, plural marriage is a more comfortable form. It's less threatening than polygamy.
Than the word polygamy. Okay.
Yeah, and plural marriage was a term used in the 19th century, so our particular brand of it. But I think polygamy, of course, was as well.
So when we get into this discussion, the other term that we hear used is spiritual wife or spiritual wifery. What is that?
So I struggle a little bit with this one because I think it kind of means different things in different contexts. And at times I think we used it, and at times we denounced it and pretended we never used it. Now, all of this, of course, was very secretive, but spiritual wife, a person you are sealed to in an eternal marriage, I think is a simple explanation. But I think there's more to it, and I need to do more work on that.
Okay. Fair enough. So we have some definitions for the conversation going forward. And when you cautioned us about presentism and looking at the past through our own lens, one of the things that we want to do is kind of picture the early 19th century religious and social context. There were things going on that informed what happened in our tradition. So what are some of those things?
And we often have a tendency to look at our story not in context, as if it just kind of fell out of the sky, when in fact we are very much influenced by what's happening around us. And I believe that the Spirit was moving on many, or that many were reacting to events in their societies, and they were questioning things like the nature of how we should live in community. And many, for multiple reasons, are choosing to live kind of all things common in different forms of these societies. And for some reason, among groups of people who chose to live all things common, as we tried but fairly quickly gave up on, sexuality often works its way into the mix. Larry Foster explored this in a book called Religion and Sexuality, a really good read for anybody who's interested. He looks at three examples. He looks at Shakers, who addressed questions of sexuality by deciding that celibacy was the way to go. Another example of that, not addressed by Foster, but Harmodists did the same thing. They chose celibacy. Others, though, like the Oneida community — you might have Oneida silverware in your drawers — Oneida community in upstate New York chose to practice complex marriage, where everybody is married to everybody else. Of course, Latter-day Saints end up experimenting with practicing plural marriage or polygamy. And there are multiple examples of different communal groups asking questions about the nature of physical human relationships, kind of experimenting with what they thought that might look like.
So as we talk about that in Community of Christ and try to put our story in context, there are lots of things that happened in our church history that are reflections of what was happening in the greater society. This is not the only thing, communitarianism and what that means, or living communally. We had the Word of Wisdom. We had all kinds of nutritional groups forming and people giving advice for that, and other religious traditions coming out of that. So there were social implications as well. So what kind of brought that on? One of the things that you've mentioned when you've talked about this is that there was so much social upheaval at the time. What do you mean by that?
I do think there was kind of a reaction to the anxiety, the unsettledness created by the Western movement, you know, people manifest destiny and people looking west and moving west, kind of uprooted. And I think there's also this reaction to the Industrial Revolution going on. And so I think that's raising questions about the nature, not just of human relationships, but of family. And people were experimenting with the definition of family and how that should be lived out. So from plural marriage among Latter-day Saints to the Shakers, where they believed everybody are brothers and sisters in the community. The Icarians had a kind of a similar idea. And I think you could see a similar concept in the 1960s. I was born in 65, so this is not firsthand knowledge, but all the Vietnam War and the protests and people turning to living in community. So we think of these kind of free love, hippie commune kind of things. I think another example of this phenomenon, and even today with the anxiety and unsettledness in the world, this is before even COVID-19, but people questioning the definition of family. So same-sex marriage, questions about polyamorous relationships, as we discussed, throuples, which people are comfortable being public about. So I think we're in a very similar time to that in which our denomination was birthed.
So that will be surprising, I think, for a lot of people to make that kind of comparison about social upheaval and looking for ways of understanding community or family, connecting those. That's really informative. Thank you. So there are some challenges in talking about this, and partly that is because it is history. We weren't there, and we are trying to not just reconstruct what happened through research and scholarship, but interpret that through our lens of our faith community. So what are some of the challenges to this as we explore it?
There's a bunch of them. Among them, that monogamy was the law of the church throughout Joseph Smith Jr.'s lifetime. So you got to kind of deal with that. Whatever was happening, it was not the law of the church as laid out in 1835 in section, what was then 101, it's now section 111 of the Community Christ Doctrine and Covenants. That's removed in the LDS tradition in 1876 and replaced with section 132, which we'll talk about later. So from section 111, we believe that one man should have one wife and one woman, but one husband, except in case of death. And that had also been lifted up in section 42, thou shalt love thy wife with all thy heart and shall cleave unto her and none else, as well as section 49, it is lawful that a man should have one wife and they twain shall be one flesh, both of those from 1831. So the kind of the law of the church, monogamy.
Okay, before we go on to the next one, this could be a tangent that they edit out. Not sure, but I have to ask. Why all those references to one wife?
Why all those references to one wife? So I think in 1831, simply lifting up the kind of the common Christian understanding of monogamy. I think by 1835, a couple of things going on. I think that there was a recognition in the larger culture that all things common in societies sometimes experimented with questions of sexuality and physical relationships. So there were a number of groups that were practicing things like complex marriage or spiritual wifery. The Cochranites, for example, which some of the early Latter-day Saints were Cochranites in name. So the fact that they joined us would raise questions. I also think that it's likely that Joseph was having what we might consider inappropriate relationships at the time, raising questions there. I do not believe that those were eternal marriages, because for a number of reasons, but Joseph, among them, didn't have the spiritual authority, even in the LDS worldview, to be able to seal those as wives. So okay. I think all of those reasons are why that question is coming up.
Thanks. That's really helpful. Maybe just for me, not our listeners, but I needed to hear that. All right. Monogamy was the church law because of all of the references and probably more that you gave us that didn't end up in the Doctrine and Covenants. What else?
So because monogamy was the law of the church, polygamy or plural marriage was always publicly denounced and denied throughout Joseph's lifetime, throughout the 1840s. So how do you make sense of public pronouncements? They're printed in the newspaper, they're in people's diaries and journals, while at the same time, a practice among a very few that differed. So that makes it really challenging to try and reconstruct. There's so many public statements denouncing and denying. Also, very rarely is plural marriage or polygamy discussed in diaries and journals at the time. And when it is, it's generally in code. So sometimes it's Masonic code, apparently. Things like SAW, meaning sealed or wed, or WAS for wedded and sealed. Sometimes it's shorthand, like maybe ME for marriage for eternity or MT for marriage for time. So if you're already skeptical, it's easy to not pay any attention to those coded references. There's even more reason to be skeptical when you start running into sources that were edited or changed when published. So for example, on 5 October of 1843 in Joseph's journal, he gave instruction to try those who were preaching, teaching, or practicing the doctrine of plurality of wives on this law. Joseph forbids it and the practice thereof. No man shall have but one wife. That seems pretty clear. Again, that's October of 43. But by the time it makes it into the LDS church history, it's a little different. Joseph gave instructions to try those persons who were preaching, teaching, and practicing the doctrine of plurality of wives. For according to the law, I hold the keys of this power in the last days. For there is never but one on earth at a time on whom the power and its keys are conferred. I have constantly said, no man shall have but one wife at a time, unless the Lord directs otherwise. So reverses the meaning completely by the time it's published. And of course, that's long after Joseph's death. So makes it easy to be skeptical if you want to be skeptical. Not even finally, but by 1860 or so and later, many participants in the discussion were so passionate about their position, meaning they were so biased in their positions, that I have a hard time paying a whole lot of attention to them. Also, ironically, a lot of the sources on plural marriage are generated decades after the events that occurred. And it's often in response to Joseph Smith III's attempts to prove his dad didn't do it. And so people in the West would say, oh, yes, he did. They would track down a justice of the peace, put together an affidavit, and they would record their memories. But I don't know about you, but my memories from 10 years ago, let alone 40, are not great. I probably know that something happened, but I cannot reconstruct paragraphs, quotes, paragraph long, but that is what historians work with when they're trying to reconstruct these stories. And so it's really easy to impeach often. If somebody said, I was sealed to Joseph on this day by this person, well, it doesn't take too much work to discover that that person was in Springfield, Illinois that day, not in Nauvoo. So yet another reason to impeach. I think it's just a faulty memory from four decades later, but you can view it differently. So for all those reasons, it is not an easy story to reconstruct. And in many cases, we just don't know a whole lot of the details.
Yeah. And that was the point of keeping it secret.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got some terms clarified and we've talked a little bit about some of the issues of context and challenges of reconstructing the story. But aside from the social upheaval of the time, we're talking about a religious tradition. Why was polygamy a part of this as far as our doctrinal understandings, our religious theological understandings? what allowed that social phenomenon to become part of the religious culture?
So there's a number of theories, a number of arguments. I don't think very few people make decisions for one reason only. Among the reasons I think probably were involved in this decision, we are restorationists, meaning they were trying to restore all things, including the things they read about in the Hebrew Bible. So since they thought it was practiced by Old Testament patriarchs, they thought they should as well. That gets a little more complex because what appeared to some to be polygamy probably was surrogacy, and that just gets a little more complex. But I think that's behind part of it.
Okay.
I think part of it is this concept addressed in section 132 for the LDS Church to raise up a righteous seed, this idea of having lots of faithful children. And I got to say, I think it works. Joseph and Emma Smith, as of 2020, have something like 1,600 descendants. Hiram Smith, and Joseph's children, of course, were not involved in polygamy. Hiram Smith's descendants go west, are involved in plural marriage. There's more than 10 times as many descendants today, somewhere over 18,000. So this idea of raising up a righteous seed, I think in some ways it's also an extension of eternal marriage. So Joseph introduces the idea in Nauvoo that you can be sealed to your beloved spouse in a way that will outlast death. In some cases, though, there were people whose first wives had died. They had been remarried. They loved their new wife dearly as well. The new wife would stand as a proxy for the deceased wife as the husband is sealed to the deceased wife. He also, of course, would want to be sealed to his new wife. So suddenly, in the afterlife, there is plural marriage. If it's okay in heaven, surely it's okay on earth. There are actually letters written from Nauvoo that describe this very situation. One in the Community Christ Archives, Jacob Scott to Mary Warnock, which I think is his daughter, he's saying, many members of the church have already availed themselves of this privilege, meaning eternal marriage, and have been married to their deceased partners. And in some cases where a man has been married to two or three wives and they are dead, he has been married to them all in the order in which he was married to them while living. So kind of an outgrowth in some ways of this idea of eternal marriage. This might be my language, but I don't think Joseph's theology was systematic. He had not carefully thought all of these things out. And so some have described that polygamy in some ways might be an accidental outgrowth of eternal marriage, meaning he didn't kind of think through the implications when he started the process. I don't know. Another reason that some lift up is this idea of dynastic polygamy, this idea that you could seal or bind leading families of the church together in a way that would last into the hereafter. Samuel Brown, in his book, In Heaven as It Is on Earth, kind of helped me understand this much better. He framed Latter-day Saintism in the context of it is all about defeating death for Joseph as individuals, as families, and as a church community. And the whole point is to defeat death and to stay together in these family relationships from Joseph's perspective. Then things like baptism for the dead by proxy, sealings of husbands and wives and children together, and even plural marriages start to make sense. I'm not saying I believe in it. I'm saying I could see if that's what Joseph was trying to accomplish, that plural marriage could be part of that, and that in his mind you could seal, just like royal families in Europe strategically marry their children, you could seal members of leading families of the church together in a way that would almost kind of drag some of them into the hereafter on Joseph's or other church leaders' coattails, in effect. So this idea of dynastic polygamy.
Well, I'm thinking about the different readings that I've come across, and it was kind of the leaders at a certain level that he trusted that were involved in plural marriage So I can see where the dynastic polygamy kind of fits that model.
Yeah. Interesting to think of. And I would guess totally new to most Community of Christ members.
Sure. I hadn't even heard that term before. So that, I don't know if it fits that model or if the descriptor and the model fits the reality of what was happening. I'm not sure which came first, but that's okay. So Nauvoo, that's what we're really talking about, is not just polygamy, but polygamy in Nauvoo. So what happened in Nauvoo, which is a big question, but just in the topic of polygamy.
I would say, again, in many cases, we don't know, but here's what I think some of the things are that we do know. Now, let me back up and say, some people argue that Joseph introduced plural marriage in Kirtland, the Kirtland period. I just do not see the evidence to support that. Some of the sources are a four-year-old Mosiah Hancock. I think people sometimes see relationships that Joseph may or may not have had with people other than Emma, and believe that if there was any kind of affection, it had to be a marriage. I just don't believe that. So I don't believe that the first plural marriage occurs until Nauvoo. I think it's likely Louisa Beeman in April of 1841. So the first plural marriage, in my understanding. They're all very secret, as we've talked about repeatedly, denounced and denied. But by 1843, Hiram Smith, who was initially opposed to plural marriage, is apparently convinced by Brigham Young that it is of God. And Hiram believes that if he could just convince Joseph to have a revelation on the topic, that he, Hiram, could take it to Emma and convince her that it was right, it was good. And I think Joseph is saying, I don't think so, Hiram. I don't think Emma's going to go for it. Hiram and Emma were good friends, so okay, let's give it a shot. William Clayton records this, and he's one of the very few writing about plural marriage in Nauvoo at the time versus decades later. He says that on 12 July of 43, they gathered in Joseph's office in the Red Brick Store. Joseph dictated, William Clayton recorded. This is what the document that would eventually become section 132 for the LDS Church. They hand this document to Hiram, who heads off to Emma, who would have been living in the homestead at the time. Hiram quickly returns and says, I have never had a worse talking to in all my life. It did not go as planned. But if this version of the story is accurate, and others tell similar versions that later, but the only reason the text for section 132 exists was to try and convince Emma to accept plural marriage. And I think it was not successful. Now, I will say, I think that Joseph did convince Emma for very brief times, like maybe a matter of minutes, that this was only a spiritual union, it was only the hereafter. I think Emma might have begrudgingly gone along with it for very short periods of time, maybe in 1842. But once she came to the conclusion that it was perhaps more complex than that, she was not a fan and did everything she could to be rid of the practice. Participants in plural marriage, I was kind of shocked, and this is based on the work of George D. Smith, his book, Nauvoo Polygamy, but we called it Celestial Marriage. I'm looking at just those who participated prior to Joseph's death. So Nauvoo had maybe 14, 15,000 citizens living in it, with maybe another 5,000 in surrounding areas. There's only, though, it seems, 33 men and 91 women participating prior to Joseph's death. So it's a really small, select group. Participation peaked in 1843. And then fell off dramatically in 1844. And I don't know any scholars who believe that Joseph took additional plural wives after the fall of 43. So I think Emma had convinced Joseph by the fall of 43 that this was not the way to go.
There are a lot of comments going through my head right now, so I am censoring them to be appropriate for our conversation here. So the whole Hiram trying to convince Emma the reality that it was happening behind Emma's back. And in some of the material that's out there to read, even to the extent that because Emma was married to a leader of the church, her friends were women who were married to leaders of the church. And so some of her friends were some of the participants. So is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. And it's, for me, among the most devastating parts of the story. Right. It appears to me that some of Emma's dear friends, trusted friends, were secretly sealed to Joseph without Emma's knowledge, which is really troubling to me. Yeah. Yeah. So that it's really, really painful.
Right. So the other thing that people bring up that causes a lot of consternation in this is the diverse ages of participants. Mm-hmm. Anything you want to say about that?
So I think that is also troubling. I think, and I'm going to get blasted for saying this, but I also think context is helpful. And although I think relationships with older men and younger women were not common at the time, I think they are far less common now. And I think even now, in many parts of the world, it still happens and we haven't done anything about it. And that pains me terribly as well. But for example, Governor Ford of Illinois was, I think, in his 20s and married a 16-year-old and is later elected governor. So I think that there was in some ways different perspectives. I think there is also questions about the nature of the relationships that we can't answer. So it is clear to me that in a number of these cases, it was a spiritual union only. I think in some of the cases, it was a physical union as well. I am not the expert, so I can't really tell which are which. Also, we lifted up the term early polyandry, and there was a reason for that. It's because in Nauvoo, most of the women that Joseph was sealed to early are married to and living with other men. And so I don't know what that means, but and I'm a little conflicted. Should I feel good that there was some equality in the nature of this? I don't think so. But that's a difficult part of the story. I just read an account where one of the young women said that her father asked Joseph if he would be sealed to his young daughter. It was part of the argument for dynastic polygamy, so that therefore the other church leader's family could be connected to Joseph into the hereafter. Again, I don't know what the nature of the relationship was, though.
Okay. All right. So some of the issues that make it a really uncomfortable topic to broach.
Yep.
So I grew up in the 1960s, and I was taught the kind of common RLDS perspective of the time that basically was Joseph never did it. Mm-hmm. But there's more to the RLDS kind of journey with understanding or looking into the practice of polygamy in church history. So when did we first begin to, as a people, suspect that our, and the way I put it is fingers in the ears, la, 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 I can't hear you talking, it never happened. When did we kind of figure out that approach wasn't going to help us going forward?
So I think there's a couple of answers to that question. I think there were always those among us, including some of the leaders, maybe, but not Joseph III, I don't know. I think there are always some among us who believe Joseph really had been involved. But I also, in some ways, want to defend the traditional RLDS position in the 20th century that he didn't do it. And we believe that because he said he didn't do it over and over and over again. So you could build a pretty powerful argument that he didn't do it. But I want to back up. It turns out that he never had anything to do with it of the 20th century and the late 19th century. Is not really where we started as a people. We started in the 1850s and 60s saying, I think he did it, but repented and we should forgive him. But as the people die off who were really there in Nauvoo, we start to shift. We start to move into this idea that he didn't do it. Brigham did it. We always love blaming Brigham Young.
Of course, of course.
Brigham did it. And then by the 1960, we began to shift again into this, well, he might have done it as an outgrowth of the eternal marriage concept. But that, you know, it's not really what he was starting towards, but that might be where he ended up. More recently, I'd say 1983 to present, or maybe even a little more, we're back, I think, to, and I say we, meaning our scholarly community, either we think he did it, or I'm actually in the, I think he did it, but I think he repented, or at least was trying to get it stopped. And I know that's going to sound like an apologetic argument, but I think there might really be something to it. And I'm not interested in apologetics. I'm interested in what the sources say. And there really are some intriguing sources, some of which we haven't paid much attention to support that position.
That he did it, but he repented.
Yeah, or at least was trying to get it stopped.
To get it stopped. And for a lot of different reasons that I can think of.
Yeah.
Being a wife, I'm thinking, you know, wives wield some power.
Yep.
Even in the mid-19th century.
I also think that it was clearly spinning out of control.
Yeah.
I don't think Joseph was killed because of polygamy. I think he was killed because of our use, and some would argue abuse, of habeas corpus. But he wouldn't have needed to be using it in that way if the whole polygamy thing hadn't ended up with the expositor and the demolition of the press, etc.
Right, right. So as a tradition, the reorganized church, our kind of a strain of restoration history, kind of went through this cycle. There were other reasons people believed what they believe. Emma denied it her whole life. Is that true?
I don't know that that's true, although we often think that. I do want to say, before I launch into some of the sources, mm-hmm. that I am very much indebted to Richard Howard and his The Changing RLDS Response to Mormon Polygamy, a Preliminary Analysis. It's a John Whitmer article from 1983, as well as Alma Blair and his RLDS Views of Polygamy, Some Historiographical Notes from 1985, also John Whitmer. Pioneers, and there were some that were even earlier, some as early as 1960, that were raising some questions, but they did critically important work. So Alma Blair points out that the position of the reorganization is consistent in that we have always been antagonistic towards polygamy. We've always thought it was immoral. What has not been been consistent is our understanding of Joseph's relationship to its introduction. So that has evolved, and sometimes with good reason. So you asked about Emma. Mm-hmm. Here's what Emma said on 9 March of 1844. So this is recorded at the time. It's in the Relief Society minutes. The Voice of Innocence, which was an article proclaiming our innocence from being involved in polygamy, was then read and approved. Emma continued further by exhorting all to take heed in their ways and follow the teachings of Brother Joseph. And when he preaches against vice, to take heed to it, and said he meant what he said, concluded her remarks by requesting all to use their common senses, and they would teach us right principles if we would adhere to them. Further, that we must be willing to forgive what has passed in consideration of repentance and Reformation. Now, she doesn't explicitly say, I'm talking about polygamy, but I really think she's talking about polygamy, right, especially when you start adding other sources. So that's 9 March. Here's what William Law, previously a member of the First Presidency, had to say on 19 March of 44. This is in his Nauvoo diary. Hiram Smith was here a few days ago. He said they were not doing anything in the plurality of wife business now, and that he had published a piece against it. So Hiram is telling William Law, we've stopped. Now, William didn't believe him. But just a couple of days previously in the Times and Seasons, Hiram had published a piece against it. There is no such doctrine, meaning plurality of wives, taught here. Neither is there any such thing practiced here. And any man that is found teaching privately or publicly any such doctrine is culpable and will stand a chance to be brought before the High Council and lose his license and membership. Hmm. So, of course, in the past, readers of that have sometimes just thought, well, that's part of the cover-up. I think it's part of the change of heart that they really were trying to get it stopped by this point in time. Isaac Sheen publishes in 1852 in the Saturday Evening Post, Joseph Smith repented of his connection with this, meaning spiritual wife doctrine, and said it was of the devil. And that is reprinted in the very first issue of the Saints Herald. Isaac was the editor. So the very first issue of the Saints Herald says, he did it, but he repented. We should forgive him. William Marx, stake president in 1840s Nauvoo, which was a far more important position then when we would understand it to be now, critically important position. But Marx says consistently and repeatedly, Joseph did it. He came to me not long before he was killed and said, I've made a mistake. I'm going to preach against it. You press charges. We got to get this stopped. Now, some people have tried to turn Marx's statements into something different. I have been deceived, says Joseph. And later we would say, yeah, you've been deceived by Brigham who secretly introduced polygamy. But that is not what William Marx was saying. Marx's first account says, Joseph, however, became convinced before his death that he had done wrong, meaning Joseph had done wrong. And Marx, again, is consistent. There's multiple accounts from him saying that. Even Brigham Young, 1866 General Conference in Utah, says, Joseph was worn out with it, meaning polygamy. But as to his denying any such thing, I never knew that he denied the doctrine of polygamy. And of course, Brigham wouldn't know because he and most of the 12 were out on campaign missions for Joseph in his run for U.S. president. They came home. William Marx, who they knew was always opposed, is saying Joseph had a change of heart. They didn't believe him. But I'm open to the sources, mm-hmm. but I think it is definitely worth considering. And the more I look, the more sources I find to suggest that Joseph really was, by spring of 44, thinking, I got to get this stopped. Now, what I'm not clear on is, did he decide it was going to destroy the church, so I got to get it stopped? Or did he decide I made the wrong decision? It is right. Wrong.
Right.
I still am kind of on the fence on that one.
Okay. So he was deceived, or he didn't do it, or it never happened, or he did it, but he repented, or, as you mentioned earlier, he might have done it by accident. That has got to be my very personal favorite of all of these. Honey, I'm so sorry, I accidentally married somebody else. I mean, how does that happen, Locke?
Yeah, so what that argument is trying to say is that the theology behind it was not carefully planned out.
That's a given.
Yeah, an unintended consequence of eternal marriage is what that argument is. Whether it's intended or unintended, I think it clearly is a consequence of eternal marriage.
Sure.
But beyond that, I don't know.
So we have had this antagonistic relationship with the whole idea of polygamy in the reorganization. And we had to grapple with it when we came to the reality that people who had gone to Utah and practicing polygamy were coming back and participating with the reorganization. So what happened with that?
So a number of different things happened with that, some of which are incredibly painful. I think in some cases, people who affiliated with the reorganization in Utah came back and left plural families behind, which is heartbreaking. I think in some other cases, they brought plural families back and supported them, but not, of course, publicly as husband and wife or even secretly as husband and wife. I think as here's my public family and it's my responsibility to take care of this family as well. It's really hard to reconstruct those stories, though, because as you can imagine, in neither case were they proud of their actions.
Right. And there wouldn't be records, marriage certificates, birth certificates, that kind of thing. There would only be what, family lore, maybe?
Family lore. And as we know, that family lore is often not particularly helpful. But Lou Wigand, a number of years ago, wrote on the topic. And I do know families in the church today whose ancestors did this. But it's pretty painful to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see why. But those relationships being severed, care of children,
yep,
and women in that age being left to fend for themselves or to be fodder for another polygamous family. Yeah.
Yep.
A lot of different reasons. So within the reorganization, in the leadership of this fledgling group of people with their antagonistic relationship to polygamy, how did that inform how they led? How did that inform doctrine and policy and praxis in the reorganization?
That's a really good question, and I don't think I have a good answer. I think Joseph III eventually came to understand that it was his role to clear his father's name. Now, he started on April 6th of 1860, the day he joined with us, saying, "I think my father was a good man. A good man would never do that. But if he did, he was wrong." But I believe that he became convinced that he hadn't done it, and was really good at convincing others of that eventually, not initially. In fact, initially, he didn't have a lot of luck. So one of my favorite stories is in 1867, now our general conferences, now world conferences, traveled at the time. And the 1867 general conference was held in Keokuk, Iowa. And prior to the conference, church leaders, including the Council of 12 and the presidency, met in the Red Brick Store in Nauvoo upstairs. And among the business they conducted was a debate about Joseph Jr. and polygamy. And I don't know that they knew this, but they were having that debate just a few feet from the room where apparently Section 132 was dictated. So whether it was intentional or not, I love the fact that they had come back to the very place where the concept was put on paper for the first time. Mm-hmm. Debate what should happen to members and leaders of the church who might believe or teach. So they passed a number of resolutions. One of them said that members who might believe in polygamy or sealing or spiritual wifery, whether it's privately or publicly, are potentially going to get in trouble. So they're in danger of the council, meaning of being charged. So
right.
you can't believe that. You can't teach that. You can't think that. And even a little harsher to what they called official members, which meant priesthood. If any of them were going to teach or endorse or encourage in public or in private, they were going to be silenced and potentially, if they didn't repent, cut off. So they're addressing it head on in 1867, which suggests that there were questions about it in the church.
Oh, absolutely. So as I went through some of your material, it's that same 1867 where a decision was made about what they would try to share openly.
Yeah, so they're debating not just about our LDS members in 1867 and what they should teach or practice, but they also end up discussing a resolution that would clear Joseph Smith Jr. of participation in plural marriage. That discussion didn't go as well, though, and they ended up tabling it on the ground that its passage would be more injurious than good because of the almost universal opinion among the saints that Joseph was in some way connected with it, meaning connected.
Okay.
So I think that's kind of interesting that there was a what they perceived to be kind of a universal opinion in 1867 that Joseph was somehow involved.
Okay. So our ongoing community with the reorganization got involved in a little bit of political response to polygamy, and I'm assuming it's because of what was happening in Utah with the territory and their bid for both territorial status and then statehood. So what was going on and what was happening in the RLDS group?
So I think as polygamy kind of rose to become one of the two major national political issues, slavery and polygamy, the twin relics of barbarism, I think we began to address it more and more. Initially, 1863, a resolution calling on members and ministers not to talk about it. But by 1870, as things are starting to fire up, we appoint a committee of five to draft a resolution or memorial to Congress setting forth the church's views. So we were intent on saying that is not us. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or Josephites is not the same Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or Brighamites that are teaching and practicing polygamy. The memorial, by the time we got done, stretched to 8 pages.
Oh my gosh.
Our attempt to make it clear that that was not us. 1876, we revisit it and are encouraging Congress to take more decisive measures in the suppression of alleged misrule and tyranny in Utah. And again, made the point that the RLDS Church were not polygamists. That was also another memorial to Congress. By 1882, we pass a resolution offering thanks to President Chester A. Arthur and others for the passage of the Edmunds Bill. But we also were concerned that that William A. Everts, U.S. Secretary of State, had decided not to allow, apparently, Mormon immigrants in the belief that they were polygamists. And we believe that that would stop our LDS members from being allowed to immigrate. And we are working with Everts to try and convince him to change his position. He refused our request and argued that law-abiding immigrants are secure against interference. So we had nothing to worry about, is his argument. I'm not sure we were convinced. It kind of fires up again in the early 20th century. And I'm not positive on this, but I think it probably is connected to Reed Smoot and his campaign and eventual election. And by the time he's seated, and there are these Reed Smoot hearings that take place over a number of years.
So for folks who aren't remembering their U.S. history, Locke, go back. He ran for Congress.
Yeah, I can't
out remember. Out of Utah.
He did. I think Senate, but this is way out of my area of expertise. And the debate was whether they should seat him or not, or because of polygamy.
Right.
And so we're passing resolutions. This is kind of early, but I still think it must be related. 1902, and again in 1903, we are reaffirmed the church's support for constitutional amendment prohibiting the practice of polygamy in all U.S. states and territories. So we kept asking for this constitutional amendment. And again, I think it has to be related to Smoot somehow, but I could be wrong. That's simply my speculation.
And at the same time, in Utah, there are the original manifesto and then the second one, and the realization that although there was a public manifesto against polygamy, the continued practice of polygamy, in reality, it was still taking place. And there was all kinds of legal battles and debate over that.
And I'm not clear how widely known, how public that final 1904 manifesto was. Mm-hmm. So that you're definitely right. That could also be part of the context, or maybe all of the context.
Well, we did tend to keep our finger on the pulse of what was happening in Utah.
Yeah.
So we did try to get, we did offer support as a body, which is interesting that we offered political support for something at that period of time. Yeah. There were other kind of battles going on, and one of them was that there was a book written about Joseph Smith called No Man Knows My History. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can. So Fawn Brodie, of course, David O. McKay's niece, wrote a biography of Joseph, and I believe that we were pretty helpful allowing her access to our archives. I'm guessing we thought it was going to be a positive portrayal. Israel A. Smith was our prophet president by that time. And my sense is that when the book came out, he felt betrayed and tricked. And so Israel spent a lot of time battling the idea that Joseph was a polygamist. Mm-hmm. So it had kind of calmed down quite a bit for the first half of the 20th century, but fired up again this battle with No Man Knows My History.
And that book is actually still available for people if they want to read Fawn Brodie's perspective.
It's a good read.
On Joseph Smith. Yeah. One of my favorite phrases about the Nauvoo period comes from that text. It was Joseph saying to his friends that something had happened and it had upset the peace of my household. Yeah. And he used that phrase many times in Brodie's book. So. All right, so let's fast forward a little bit and let's talk about the RLDS Church having to come to grips with polygamy again in the 1960s when the church had gone into India and there was now an issue about polygamous groups joining the church. And just for our listeners' information, David Howlett, who's part of the church historian team for Community of Christ, did a Project Zion podcast on India where he just touched on this subject, but it has a big connection to the issue of polygamy for the reorganization. So what's going on?
It does, and it results in what I think might be one of our proudest moments, although I wish I had been aware of what was happening. So we're expanding internationally. We are going into polygamous cultures, non-Christian cultures, and we are interacting with people who like what we have to say and want to be baptized, but of course they're polygamists, and what do we do about that? What we did eventually, and this was highly controversial, is decide that we would baptize them. We would allow them to keep their plural spouses as long as they agreed not to take any more plural wives and that they would raise their children as monogamists. And it kind of worked from what I can tell. We knew that to require them to cast off their spouses or to leave them, as some of our early members did tragically, would be, in this context, a death sentence. And so by 1972, we receive section 150 of the Doctrine and Covenants. This is W. Wallace Smith, 1972, again, saying that the church must be willing to bear the burden of their sin, is the language from the time. So basically, we would take their sins upon ourselves. We would baptize these people in the hopes that monogamy would triumph in the end. And it kind of did.
So this would have been tough on a lot of people who'd kind of spent their entire religious life with this anti-polygamy battle, anti-polygamy stance, the claims that had been made, the rhetoric that had been offered, all of that. So what are your thoughts on that and how that affected the church as a whole? Did it prepare us for changes to come or did it make changes more difficult?
So I think that this is a high point for the church to to be willing to see through the emotion. We defined ourselves by our opposition to polygamy, as you suggested, for so long. But to recognize what now we would say is the worth of the women and children, and that we had something to share that could be transformative in wonderful, powerful ways, and to be brave enough as a people to make that move is just incredible to me. And wonderful irony that we ended up in a place where we knowingly have polygamous members. And of course, our cousins in the West are horrified at that thought in their own tradition. I just think it's stunning and amazing and wonderful that we were willing to take this step, really to step out in faith. And I think it's kind of an early step that leads onto the path of community of Christ. Maybe one of the early expressions of what the church was becoming.
And we have been on a journey of becoming. So where are we now with some of this? Now, you said that there are lots of different perspectives, and you're sharing yours on this. So is this talked about outside of historical conferences and that kind of thing? Are people more accepting of the sources, the source material? I know in my own family, some of my family members have been less than willing to accept source material that came out of the Utah Church or descendants from the Utah Church. What's going on now in this whole topic?
So here's where I think we're at, and it doesn't quite work, but I like to think of this as we are going through the stages of grief when it comes to Joseph and polygamy, that we believed him for so long, we defended him for so long, and then to discover that perhaps we were wrong, just devastating. So I think we went through denial. I think we went through anger, and I think some of our members are still there for people who, and I meet Latter-day Saints and Latter-day Seekers in this place as well, who are just so angry with Joseph that they can't see any of the positive. If you come from a black and white world and Joseph was revered, and suddenly it's clear that he made some mistakes, some big mistakes, then the only thing that can be, if he's not revered, he has to be evil. Right. There's no in between. It's black or white. It's good or bad, good or evil. I think the world is not black and white. I think life takes place in the gray. I think Joseph was capable of great good and significant mistakes. I think in some ways he's deeply flawed. I think many of us skip the bargaining and the depression stage of the stages of grief. And some of us are moving into the acceptance stage that allows us to embrace not just the wonderful and positive of Joseph, as well as recognize and admit and repent for the negative. But it also allows us, I think more importantly, to reconnect with the amazing parts of our story that we just weren't thinking about, didn't want to talk about, it was just too painful. So I think that's part of where we're at now. I also think there's this really strange swapping of positions that has taken place. I fairly regularly now meet members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who believe that Joseph had nothing to do with polygamy.
Yes.
And they think that, although they don't really recognize this, in many cases is they have embraced the work of Richard Price, now deceased, who was a leader in the Restoration Schism in the Community of Christ. He gathered all kinds of sources on Joseph and polygamy. Now, I think Richard, my take is that he knew what the answer was when he started, and he didn't let the sources sway him. And I don't think that's the best way to do history. Mm-hmm. But I also think that he has an amazing collection of sources that I can interpret through my own lens. But his material has infiltrated the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and particularly the followers of Denver Snuffer, in ways that I don't think they recognize. So it's not uncommon now for me to encounter folks from the LDS tradition who think Brigham did it, Joseph had nothing to do with it, while I bump into members from Community Christ who think, well, I think he might have had something to do with it. So this really interesting role reversal. I also think that DNA and genetics have added a really fascinating and kind of puzzling piece to this equation. So, you know, the old RLDS defense was always, well, there are no children of Joseph's from other than Emma. Well, how do you really know for most of the generations we made that argument? Again, because most of the women sealed to Joseph early were married to and living with their husbands. Mm-hmm. So if there's a child, whose child is it? More recently, DNA has allowed us to try and find out, are some of these families who thought that they were really Joseph's descendants, but not from Emma, are they? And that genetic study has been going on for, you know, 15 years now, maybe. And to this point, there's no genetic evidence that Joseph had children from other than Emma. Some people have argued that Dr. Bennett knew how to perform abortions, and I think he probably did. But I also think the whole point of plural marriage was to raise up a righteous seed. It just doesn't make any sense to me that would be why there are no children from other than Emma. Mm-hmm. So that's caused me to kind of step back and reconsider the nature of the relationships. We already knew that some were only spiritual, not physical, but I still think some are physical. Some have suggested maybe that there was a one-time consummation of the marriage in some mm-hmm. cases, but of course that would reduce the likelihood of children. But I just don't know how to make sense of that part yet. Interesting.
Yeah.
So much we don't know.
But it took how long for Sally Hemings and her descendants to be honored?
Yeah, but in their case, the genetic evidence supported the traditional understanding.
Yeah, but it took a while to find her and find them and find that.
Yeah. In Joseph's case, of course, that could still turn up, but some of the family lines tested were not good candidates to begin with. These were geneticists, mm-hmm. not historians that were doing this work, but they've also tested the best candidates. Mm-hmm. And it is only piece of the puzzle. So you need documentary evidence that you also can combine, but based on the documentary evidence, the best candidates now have been tested and they are not Smiths. So I don't know what to make of that.
One of the mysteries of trying to piece it back together.
One of many.
So when we talk about polygamy in Nauvoo, we talk a lot about Emma. And what did she know? When did she know it? Those kinds of things. But other than the effect it had on Emma and our using her lifelong denial as our kind of banner.
Not lifelong.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, he repented. No, we modified that denial.
So William McClellan suggests that in 1847, she did for a very brief period talk about it.
Okay.
And later she says things like, well, Joseph said that if everybody lived righteously, you know, this might be able to work, but, you know, it didn't. Kind of thing. But she was consistent, I think, in her public statements that she was Joseph's only
wife. Yes. And that was to her deathbed, was it not? That he had but one
testimony. And I think she's right. I think that Joseph only had one legal wife. Now, Joseph III had a really legalistic mind and he had to get it from somewhere. I think he got
right.
it from him.
I know in my own life, I'm really careful about how I phrase things. So absolutely, we need to look at that.
Yeah.
When we talk about this, though, we talk about the women in the plural marriages, women who were affected by this, and we seem to talk about them from the perspective of the men to whom they were sealed or married, or refer to them through which leader they were married to. You talk about the wife of Kimball, the wife of William Law, the wife of. So it kind of allows us to keep what was happening at arm's length and not make it real, because we're not dealing with women involved as human beings. We're dealing with them as appendages to men. So if we begin to name what happened, and you talked about that, and the women become people to us in our study of history, many of them manipulated or coerced into participating, how do we learn their stories as a people, community of Christ? How do we learn their stories? And can we learn to claim them as we claim Emma, as women of faith, not simply as victim?
Yeah, there's a couple, there's many things I think at play there. One of them is that we're products of our culture as well. And so until recent years, that's how we saw the world. So, you know, we are the Joseph Smith Historic Site. Now, I thought we were doing pretty good when we picked that name in, you know, 2000 or so, because we understood it to be not just Joseph Smith Jr., but Joseph Sr. and Joseph III. I thought, well, you know, I like that. Of course, if we did it today, I would want to call it the Emma and Joseph Smith Historic Site, or the Joseph and Emma Smith Historic Site. Part of me wants to put Emma first because she was here so much longer. This, her story is decades and decades long here. We did, when we did write-ups for the homes here, we have interpretive signs in front of a lot of the houses, and we included the wife's name as well, which I feel good about. But that transition has really even only happened in my own life since 2000. I know I'm a latecomer, but as historians, we also are a little handicapped in that most of the source material focuses on the men, and there's not a lot to work with from the women. There's really very little written by Emma, for example, and it's a challenge. It's hard to overcome. So we have to be intentional about capturing and reclaiming the stories of the wives, of the women that I think are critically important. I think for Community of Christ today, maybe more important, because we already know those other stories.
Right.
But often the women who were so focused on caring for the others, you know, the abolished poverty and suffering focus, nobody was doing it better than the women. I wonder if that's a sexist statement. I need to think about that. So I think admit our failures, repent, and pledge to do better is what we can do.
Yeah.
I think that we talk about worth of persons, and we need to recognize that we didn't view women as of equal worth in the 19th century, and I still don't think we're there today. We've got plenty of room for improvement. But those are just a few of the things I think we can draw from it.
Sure. And the historical nature of highlighting the accomplishments of the men obviously plays into this. But I think also our anti-polygamy DNA, if you will, in the organization makes us not really wanting to learn the stories of the women who would have been plural wives. I think that makes us uncomfortable. Yeah.
No question. And I struggle internally with that as well. For example, my earlier statement that these were not wives, and legally they're not, but is that degrading or somehow suggesting that they're less than? Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know either. But if we're talking about matters of faith and we talk about women entering into plural marriage, I think we have to be willing to look at that and say, what does that teach us also about the blessings of community?
Yeah.
So
yeah. I do think it's fascinating that when Todd Compton's book, In Sacred Loneliness, which is a collection of biographies of the women he understands were sealed to Joseph, from some scholars in the Church of Jesus Christ, Todd was savaged in part because I think of the way he cited his sources. It was pretty roughly received. And I think that Mark Scheer, on behalf of Community of Christ, made a statement that was, "We support good scholarship wherever that leads." So,
yeah. What a turnaround.
Yeah.
No, yeah.
He didn't explicitly say, "I think this is good scholarship." It was probably a little politically sensitive, but yeah, it was a turnaround.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we conclude our conversation about this, do you have any closing wise words for us on this topic as we might want to explore it, or any last thoughts
about this? I just think it's fascinating that when we're open, all of us in Nauvoo tell the story of this community and have spent decades doing it while never talking about plural marriage, when it is so critically important to the story. And it, I'm just I can't understand how we can tell the story without talking about it, although we've done it for a long, long time. But the other side of that is, of course, that although we don't talk about it much now unless asked, and then we're happy to talk openly and honestly, they also didn't talk about it in the 1840s. So
yeah.
Maybe it's appropriate. I do
carrying on the tradition.
Yeah, I do think that we're all moving into a place where we have to be more comfortable claiming our past. As I've said repeatedly, the wonderful, powerful, glorious, and the painful. It's ours, whether we like it or not. And by claiming it, it frees us to move forward.
It does indeed, and allows us to look at how we've been shaped and formed as a people. Well, I want to thank you, Locke, for having this conversation with me about polygamy in Nauvoo. If our listeners would like to learn more on this topic, you've mentioned a number of places where they can look. If you are interested in how the church talks about it in its missionary material, you can look at the Illustrated Church History, and it's referenced in that text. You can also find Mark Scheer's treatment of the topic in Volume 1 of Journey of a People. There are the two John Whitmer Historical Society articles that Locke referenced. And Locke, do you have any other pieces of information where people might look on this topic?
I think that's where I'd start. Those four would be a great place to start.
All righty. So, Locke, thank you again for this conversation. And for our listeners, this has been an episode of Cup of Joe for the Project Zion podcast. I'm Karen Peter. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.